Good day, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Brookfield Property Partners first quarter of 2016 results conference call. As a reminder, today's call is being recorded. If you would like to ask a question at any time, please press star followed by the digit 1 on your telephone keypad. If you're using a speakerphone, please make sure your mute function is turned off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. It is now my pleasure to turn the call over to Mr. Matthew Cherry, Vice President of Investor Relations and Communications. Please go ahead, sir.
Thank you and good morning, everyone. Before we begin our presentation, let me caution you that our discussion will include forward-looking statements. These statements that relate to future results and events are based on our current expectations. Our actual results in future periods may differ materially from those currently expected because of a number of risks, uncertainties, and assumptions. The risks, uncertainties, and assumptions that we believe are material are outlined in our news release issued this morning. With that, I'll turn the call over to our CEO, Brian Kingston.
Thank you, Matt. Good morning, everyone. Thank you for joining our call. With me on the call today are Rick Clark, Chairman of BPY, and Brian Davis, our CFO. In my prepared remarks, I will provide an update on our strategic priorities, as well as some observations on real estate fundamentals and the investment environment, as well as our outlook for the balance of 2016. Brian will go through our quarterly financial results, and then following those comments, we would be happy to take questions from analysts and investors on the call today. As you would have seen in our press release this morning, we reported strong earnings growth for the first quarter of 2016, with an increase in company FFO per unit of 24% over last year. Our results continue to benefit from leasing in our office portfolio, strong performance in our core retail business, and investments that we made over the course of 2015. We also benefited from lower interest costs as a result of the repayment of the Brookfield Office Properties acquisition facility. While debt and equity capital markets experienced some volatility in the early part of the year, fundamentals in all of our major markets remain sound. Real estate investment activity in most markets continues to be robust, and we're hopeful this increase in volatility will create some attractive investment opportunities for us to acquire high-quality real estate assets on a value basis. In last quarter's letter to unit holders, we laid out four strategic priorities that we would be focused on in 2016. The first was to enhance our balance sheet flexibility by increasing the capacity and extending the maturity of our corporate credit facilities. Following the receipt of a corporate credit rating of BBB from S&P in February, we refinanced our corporate credit facility, increasing its capacity from $2 to $2.5 billion and extending its maturity to 2019. The cost of this new facility is 55 basis points lower than the one that it replaced. At the property level, we completed refinancings of over $2 billion on maturing loans in our core office portfolio during the quarter, resulting in net incremental proceeds of approximately $500 million and reducing interest costs by 30 basis points. We also secured a $375 million construction loan facility to support an apartment development project at Canary Wharf in London. Subsequent to quarter end, we further extended our maturity profile by issuing $200 million Canadian dollars of perpetual preferred shares with an initial fixed coupon of 6% from Brookfield Office Properties. The proceeds from this issue will be used to repay BPO's Series H capital securities, which are currently redeemable on demand by holders. Our second priority for the year was to continue our program of recycling capital from mature, stable assets into higher-returning investment strategies by surfacing between $1 and $2 billion of net equity. During the first quarter, we closed on the sale of an office building in Vancouver and a retail property in Sydney that netted a total of $400 million of net proceeds to BPY. So far, during the second quarter, we have completed or are contracted to complete further asset sales, which will result in net proceeds of an additional $1 billion. These asset sales were all completed at premiums to their IFRS carrying values, which just highlights that the value of our real estate portfolio is far in excess of where our shares are currently trading. Our third priority for the year was to increase occupancy in our core office and core retail platforms to 94% on a same-store basis. During the quarter, we completed over 1.5 million square feet of leasing in our core office portfolio and 5.1 million square feet in our core retail portfolio. We also continued to make good progress in leasing our development projects, signing a 115,000 square foot lease with Jefferies Group at 100 Bishopsgate in London, and are in ongoing discussions with eight tenants representing over 3 million square feet of space at our Manhattan West project in New York City. Finally, we said that in addition to recycling cash from asset sales into new investments and paying down debt, we would also look to repurchase our own units should they continue to trade at a meaningful discount to NAV. Since starting to actively repurchase units in the third quarter of 2015, we have bought back almost 2 million units at an average price of $21.86, which is 27% below our IFRS value per share. With the repayment of the BPO acquisition facility and refinancing of our corporate credit facility both completed, and good progress made on achieving our targeted asset sales for the year, we're now in a position to ramp up these efforts and expect to be more active, particularly if our units continue to trade at a discount to where we're seeing private market sales occur. At this point, I'll hand the call over to Brian for our quarterly financial report.
Thank you, Brian. During the first quarter, we earned company FFO of $217 million, compared with $181 million for the same period in 2015. On a per-unit basis, FFO for the current quarter was 31 cents per unit, compared with 25 cents per unit in the prior year, an increase of 24% as operating performance was strong across all business units. Net income for the quarter was $251 million, or 35 cents per unit, and includes fair value gains of $147 million. Although not reflected in current period FFO and only partially reflected in current period net income, we realized gains of $314 million, or 44 cents per unit, on assets that were sold in the quarter as a result of strong execution on the sale of Royal Center in Vancouver and World Square Retail in Sydney at prices well in excess of the capital we had invested in these assets. These realized gains, combined with our FFO this quarter, provide strong support for our increased quarterly distribution of 28 cents per unit that was paid at the end of March and represents an almost 6% increase over prior periods. In reviewing our Q1 company FFO in a little more detail, the main drivers that contributed to the $36 million year-over-year growth were an increase in same property net operating income in natural currency across our core office and retail platforms of over 10% and 4% respectively, as well as same property growth in certain of our opportunistic investments, including our multifamily, industrial, and hospitality assets. Investment activity, specifically into our new strategic real estate fund, which acquired interests in Center Parcs in the UK, Associated Estates in the US, and an office portfolio in Brazil, and most recently a self-storage portfolio in the U.S., these investments contributed $16 million to company FFO. A reduction in corporate interest expense as we paid down our BPO acquisition facility in full during the prior year, and this was offset by asset sales, which reduced company FFO by $16 million, and a reduction in FFO of $9 million from our exposure to foreign currencies that weakened relative to the U.S. dollar. In arriving at company FFO, which we detail on page 9 of our supplemental, amongst our standard adjustments for net contribution to company FFO from our GGP warrants and the add-back of depreciation of non-real estate assets, we adjusted for $9 million in transaction costs related to recent acquisitions and $6 million of gains on non-investment properties related primarily to our share of a gain earned by GGP on the sale of marketable securities. Not included in our earnings this quarter is income recognized by GGP from their share of the Ala Moana condominium development project as a result of a difference between IFRS and U.S. GAAP, which requires that we defer recognition until a later date. If there were no GAAP difference, our company FFO would have increased by $11 million to $228 million, or 32 cents per unit for the quarter. Included in net income, we recorded fair value gains of $147 million during the quarter. The majority of these gains were in our opportunistic sector investments, notably our multifamily, suburban office, and industrial assets. In our multifamily business, we completed a number of renovation projects at select assets, which resulted in higher rents. And in our suburban office and European industrial portfolio, we were the beneficiaries of leasing activity that increased property-level cash flows. These increased cash flows resulted in valuation gains in the quarter. In our core office portfolio, our fair values benefited from the successful execution of the sale of Royal Center in Vancouver at a price $33 million above where we had marked the asset at the end of Q4. In addition, in New York, our values increased to reflect higher cash flows through a combination of the burn-off of free rent periods and higher rents in the terminal year. These gains were offset by lower values in our energy markets of Houston and Calgary. In aggregate, we wrote down this portfolio by approximately $150 million in the quarter to reflect impact to future cash flows of current leasing market. This relatively modest impact to value is largely due to our contracted cash flows to high credit quality tenants, which in Calgary have an average term of 10 years and in Houston of 4 years. In comparing our results to the fourth quarter of 2015, company FFO decreased by $25 million from $242 million earned in that period. This decrease was primarily due to seasonality in our retail assets, which benefit from the holiday shopping season in their fourth quarter earnings results. We did not have any new leases impacting earnings at Brookfield Place, New York this quarter. As discussed in previous quarters, we benefited from tenants who began to occupy their space toward the end of last year and began recognizing income at a run rate of $15 million per quarter or $60 million on an annual basis. Over the balance of the year, mainly in Q3 and Q4, we expect to see the same trend, with tenants occupying space and adding another $15 million per quarter in income, bringing us to $120 million on an annual basis by the end of the year. On our proportionate balance sheet, our total assets remain largely unchanged at $66 billion. Our focus through the first quarter of this year was to continue to make progress in increasing the flexibility of our balance sheet, as Brian had mentioned. We achieved this through entering into a new three-year corporate credit facility for $2.45 billion with 15 of our banking relationships. This new facility allowed us to extinguish our $1 billion line with our parent Brookfield Asset Management. And subsequent to quarter end, we issued a $200 million rate reset preferred share through our wholly owned office subsidiary that will be used to repay a series of capital securities that are redeemable on demand. This will further extend the maturity profile of our capital. And although the coupon on this preferred share may seem high relative to where corporate level debt could be issued, this security provides us with perpetual capital and our option to redeem in 5 years, something that you don't get when you issue debt and worth the incremental cost to us. Lastly, and we continue to be successful in executing on our asset sales program to raise capital to fund development, to fund our commitments to our fund investments, and to repay corporate level debt. And as Brian mentioned, we expect to execute a few more transactions in the coming weeks and months that will further enhance our liquidity position. We ended the quarter with an IFRS value per unit of $30. This is consistent with where we ended the prior year, as the benefit of earnings and a stronger foreign currency at the end of the quarter was offset by the mark-to-market of our currency hedges, an adjustment to equity related to a transaction in the quarter, and our distributions paid. And speaking of distributions, our board of directors yesterday declared a quarterly distribution of 28 cents per unit to be paid at the end of June. With that, I'll turn the call back over to you, Brian.
Thank you, Brian. Before getting to questions, I'll provide a brief operating report from each of our three business segments. Our global office portfolio finished the quarter at 92% occupancy on 1.5 million square feet of total leasing. Our core office markets of New York, London, Toronto, and Sydney continue to perform well. Office tenant demand remains healthy, although decision-making has slowed modestly in the face of uncertainty around the U.S. election later on this year, as well as the referendum vote in June in the U.K. Fundamentals in our commodity-driven markets continue to be challenging, but our earnings are insulated through long-term leases to high-credit tenants and only modest development exposure. Government markets are stable with continued healthy private investment demand. Occupancy in our core retail portfolio finished the quarter at 95.2%, a 110 basis point increase from the same period in the prior year. Over 1,200 leases were signed during the quarter, comprising 5.1 million square feet, with suite-to-suite releasing rates at 25% on average higher for leases that are commencing in 2016. Tenant sales increased 2% to $20.3 billion. In our Class A mall business, which represents about a quarter of the top 400 malls in the United States, we have stable occupancy, increasing traffic, and fewer tenant bankruptcies than we did a year ago. And while the impact of e-commerce and changing customer tastes continually brings new challenges to our tenants, our belief is that this is nothing new, and high-quality, well-located shopping centers like the ones that we own will continue to form the bedrock of retail spending in the United States. Redevelopment initiatives continue to be the focus of our growth strategy, and we see numerous opportunities to put between $300 and $500 million of new capital to work each year at very high rates of return relative to where we could make new acquisitions in this space. Our opportunistic investing strategy occurs primarily through our participation in Brookfield-sponsored private equity funds, which provides us exposure to higher returning strategies than our core portfolios provide while mitigating risk by partnering with other investors. You may have seen recently that we held a final close on our latest global opportunity fund with total investor commitments of $9 billion. BPY's commitment to this fund was $2.3 billion, or about 25%. During the first quarter, the fund closed on the acquisition of a portfolio of self-storage assets in the United States. The gross purchase price was about $1 billion, and BPY's share of the equity was just over $100 million. We see this as an attractive opportunity to build scale in a highly fragmented sector with high growth and high cash yields. The fund has already made several follow-on acquisitions at very attractive returns. Subsequent to quarter end, the fund acquired a student housing business in the UK that owns a portfolio of 13 high-quality assets totaling some 5,700 units for about $600 million US dollars. BPY's equity was about $50 million in this transaction. The assets have an average age of just 5 years and are located in four very attractive university markets. We view the UK student housing sector as a compelling investment opportunity given the supply-demand imbalance in the market. And similar to self-storage, we are seeing plenty of opportunities to put more capital to work in this sector. So in closing, despite some of the macroeconomic headwinds that are affecting certain pockets of the global economy, we are experiencing record interest in capital from around the globe seeking to invest in our core flagship assets and opportunistic strategies. And while there is no shortage of opportunities for us to continue to attract this capital and assist with the continued growth of our business, we'll continue to execute on our strategic objectives, seeking to provide investors total returns of between 12 and 15% from our various strategies. And with those remarks, we're happy to turn the call over to any questions from analysts or investors on the line. Operator?
Thank you. And ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please signal by pressing star 1 on your telephone keypad. If you're using a speakerphone, please make sure your mute function is turned off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. Again, star 1 to ask a question. And we'll now take our first question from Mark Rothschild with Canaccord.
Thanks, and good morning, guys. Maybe in regards to the unit repurchases, your comments on the call and in the letter to unit holders said that you'd be repurchasing units should they continue to trade at a meaningful discount to NAV. That's been consistent for the last little while, and considering where you guys have guided to NAV going in your presentations, that is significantly higher than the current unit, than the current NAV as well. So I'm curious if there's a point, you know, is it 20%, is it 30% where you would be significantly more active?
You know, I'm not sure we can give you a specific number to point to, but, you know, clearly where we're trading today, which is about 20%, we view that as significantly below where the underlying value is. As you said, the NAV is, our expectation is that NAV will continue to grow 10 to 12% a year. The asset sales that we have been executing demonstrate that that it's probably a conservative view at best at the moment of what our NAV is. And so at these sort of levels, you know, I view that as significantly undervalued. I'm not sure where the cutoff where it becomes less active is, but hopefully that answers your question.
Yeah, and then kind of related, you sold a number of your mature office properties, or at least partial interest in many of them, or a number of them. How do you think about asset sales going forward and measuring this versus acquisitions, which appear to generally be more in the opportunistic bucket?
Yeah, you know, look, I think this is how we've sort of always operated the business over the last 20 years, which is we acquire these assets that have maybe some leasing challenges or require some capital or otherwise need to be repositioned, bring them to a point where they are stable and have bond-like characteristics, and then either sell out completely or sell down an interest or to take our capital out of it and then redeploy it into the next strategy. So it's really just a continuation of that. And we think, as you know, a lot of the assets that we are acquiring, as you say, on a more opportunistic basis, really fit that profile. And as they become more mature, it creates new opportunities or new assets to resurface that capital out of.
Okay, great. And just lastly, and maybe this, I don't know if this is something you can provide now on the call, but is it possible just to quantify, get the timing and the amount of NOI that in Brookfield Place, New York, as it's coming online, just to help us with understanding the numbers?
So I think I mentioned in my prepared remarks that currently we have $15 million per quarter that's included in our results. We expect that $15 million to stay consistent through Q2 of this year. And then moving into Q3, towards the end of Q3, we'll probably start to see half of the remaining 15 that I had talked about, with by the end of Q4, the total of the remaining 15 that I talked about. So by the end of Q4, we should be close to the $120 million run rate on an annual basis. Hopefully that helps.
Yes, thank you very much.
Okay, thanks, Mark.
And we'll now take our next question from Mario Saric with Deutsche Bank.
Hi, good morning. Brian, maybe just a quick clarification on the comment that sales were done at a 22% or 22% above IFRS value. Was that applicable to the $0.4 billion net equity completed during Q1? Or does that also include the incremental $1 billion that you expect to close shortly?
Yeah, the 22% relates to the $400 million that was completed in Q1.
Okay, and then if we were to look at the $1.4 billion in total, would the number be fairly different from that?
The billion in Q2 is not at 22%. So, off the top of my head, it'll be more in the probably on average about 10 to 12% above IFRS. I think when you blend the two in the 1.4.
Got it. So, okay. So coming back to the asset sales, so you've done or you will have done about $1.4 billion shortly. Your target for 2016 was $1 to $2 billion. Of net equity, given the kind of insatiable demand by institutional investors for core product, does it incentivize you or lead you to perhaps increase that target, especially given where the units are trading today?
Potentially. I think the assets that we have sold, these were, when we said at the start of the year what we were targeting for the $2 billion, we obviously already had some of these underway or in mind. The timing, although we've done a little over half of it now in the first half of the year, as you would expect, it's going to be quiet over the summer. I think the two is probably still a good number for the year. It's possible, if markets remain strong, that we may take advantage of that and do a little more, but I don't think it'll be dramatically more.
Okay. And then this may be more of a philosophical question, but, you're continuing to sell assets at kind of well above IFRS valuation, was 13% above in Q4, 22% in Q1, and then let's say 10 to 12% on an average basis going forward. What do you think the market's missing? Why do you think the unit price isn't reflecting the true private kind of value of the underlying assets?
I guess specifically as to why I think we're achieving sales that are well in excess of IFRS, I think given we're in a relatively robust market right now, that's not surprising. IFRS is a very long-term view on the values, and it's not meant to be necessarily a point-in-time valuation. So at times like this when the markets are strong, you would expect that that asset sales would be happening somewhere above IFRS. So I don't think the delta between the sale prices and the IFRS is that surprising to us, given how the approach to IFRS generally happens. But if your question is with respect to the share price relative to those values, I don't have a great answer for you. I'm not clear on why it does trade at a discount.
Okay. And then maybe just from a leverage perspective, it seems like floating rate exposure is coming down, and there's a lot of kind of ins and outs in terms of, you know, capital leaving, capital coming in on asset acquisition and dispositions. Could you maybe just give us an update in terms of, kind of where you stand debt to cap today and kind of where the goalposts are in terms of target, in terms of both the time and quantity of kind of debt reduction going forward?
Yeah, today we're, you know, either 52 to 53% debt to capital. As we'd mentioned in previous calls, our target is to get to the 50% debt to capital level, and it's definitely something that we're focused on over the balance of this year. Still left to execute on are the repayment of some of the fund subscription facilities. Those will be repaid as a result of fund capital calls that we expect to happen over the balance of the year. That combined with, you know, asset sales, reducing, you know, our non-recourse asset-specific mortgages and providing excess capital that we can use to repay our corporate credit facilities, I think will get us towards that goal. We might not get to 50% by the end of the year, but we're trending in that direction, and I think that's our focus over the long term. Maintaining a 50% debt to capital is something that I think we're comfortable in operating our business with.
Okay, well, that's helpful. And then just maybe at what point would you expect, like BSREP 1, you know, at what point would you expect kind of harvesting of assets from that fund to accelerate, and, you know, can that timing coincide somewhat with the capital requirements for BSREP 2?
So you know, we are the funds started making investments in late 2012, so we're about 4 and a bit years into it. Generally, most of the realizations I would expect to happen between 5 and 7 years. So you will start to see some realizations happening as we get further into 2016. But the bulk of it will probably be 2017, 2018. BSREP 2 is obviously in its investment period right now. So it will be fairly close, but it's more likely the third series in the fund that will coincide with the larger realizations out of the first fund.
Okay, and maybe last question for me, just pertaining to your presence in London, which is very high quality and meaningful. Can you talk about how Brookfield is thinking about, you know, any potential implications from the June 23rd referendum on your future investment strategy in the UK, number one, and number two, whether you're seeing any kind of impact on real estate fundamentals and valuation in the interim amidst the uncertainty over the outcome?
Meryl, hi, it's Rick. Maybe I'll start that, Brian. So the referendum's late June. You know, the outcome is uncertain. I think the majority of the people we talk to think that the UK will stay in the European Union, but it's really a jump ball. So if, you know, under the scenario where the UK exits, it will take many years, we think, to sort of sort that out. So we don't think there'll be immediate impact on our business. But having said that, we are seeing a bit of a slowdown in decision making leading up to it. You know, it's not unlike a slowdown in decision making that's occurring in the U.S. We think pending the outcome of the presidential election. So, you know, we're keeping a close eye on it, spending a lot of time in Europe, you know, we're happy with our assets, working hard to get them leased. I think we'll be in good shape no matter what happens.
Okay, and you sold a partial stake in a development there. Like, are you seeing any impact on valuations in the market today?
We have not so far.
Okay, great. That's it for me. Thank you.
Good.
Once again, ladies and gentlemen, that is star one to ask a question on today's conference. And we'll now take our next question from Michael Bilerman with Citi.
Hey, good morning, guys. I'm curious, Brian, you, in your opening comments, talked about the volatility in the capital markets and the hope that that potentially could open up some opportunities. I was wondering if you can sort of drill down a little bit more in terms of where do you see those opportunities coming? Is it volatility in sort of public listed securities prices, which could give you an opportunity to do more privatizations like AEC and Rouse? Is it geography in terms of where that volatility? So is Brexit creating some of that opportunity? Is it in Asia? Is it in the U.S.? Or is it in sort of what's happening with the CMBS maturities that are coming down the pike this year and next from a lot of the 5-year and 10-year deals that had been done in 2006 and 2011? I guess where do you sort of see the biggest opportunities from that volatility?
I guess we are seeing opportunities in a lot of places around the world, but the comment that I sort of made was referring specifically to the U.S. And more around CMBS maturities and changes in banking regulations and the impact that's having on the more leveraged buyers of assets. And so I think really the opportunity comes from a few places. The volatility we saw in public markets both created some potential opportunities for privatizations or carve outs of assets from public companies. But the other thing that it did was lessened competition on some of the private transactions we were looking at, which given where share prices were, it made the REITs a little less competitive or less aggressive in bidding. And so it's not full scale distress that we're seeing, obviously, but it is this volatility does tend to lessen competition on some of the transactions, and I think that's the real thing that we're trying to take advantage of at the moment, given that we do have a fairly large war chest with the opportunity fund and are able to move quickly and write large checks. When you have that kind of volatility, it tends to be a small number of larger players that can do that.
Now, is there any property type within the CMBS stuff that you're looking at or any certain markets where you see that opportunity?
No, we're seeing it across a lot of different sectors. Yeah.
And then as you think about sectors, the traditional core Brookfield from many years ago, was really in the core property types, office, and then, expanded into retail and expanded into multifamily and industrial. There's really sort of four pillars. And then you did some lodging. You now have done student housing, self-storage. How further into this specialty field would you be willing to go? What other sort of types of assets would you consider? Manufactured housing, data centers? Would you think about billboards or towers? I mean, how far would you take the investment scope, and how much of it's just a sort of a chase of higher yields within some of those specialty sectors?
Yeah, so the way we sort of think about our capital is about 80% of the balance sheet today is invested in core office, core retail, and multifamily. And the other 20% is in these more opportunistic strategies that I mentioned are primarily us putting capital to work through Brookfield private equity funds. And so within that 20%, I think any or all of the sectors that you just mentioned are potentially investable asset classes, and it's really about generating higher returns than you would typically see on the core side of the portfolio. And at the moment, as you mentioned, particularly some of those sectors, they're generating very high cash yields, which is particularly attractive given the investment environment today. So I think you could see us committing relatively modest amounts of capital through that strategy to a number of these newer sectors, and we really view it as opportunistic. It may be that 5 to 10 years from now, we don't have any investment in some of those sectors. But core office, core retail, multifamily will be here for the longer term. The rest of it is more transactional based on where we see the opportunities.
And then thinking about NAV, I've always tried to think about NAV as a backstop to value, not a driver of value. And sometimes there's impediments in listed securities that don't allow a stock to trade relative to its NAV. And as I think about BPY, and I'm curious how you think about it, you think about owning public shares as well as private assets and stuff in JVs, stuff in the funds. You think about being a limited partnership based in Bermuda with no voting rights for the public shareholders. You think about being global. You think about being diversified by many, many different property types, being externally managed, having a majority shareholder in Brookfield. being more levered than the rest of the publicly listed, at least U.S. REIT companies, and, you know, in totality, obviously, all of those things adding up to a lot of complexity. How do you weigh all of those sorts of factors in terms of the trading price of your stock relative to the trading price of what you're, what you could sell individual assets for?
Well, you know, I'm not sure I agree that everything that you just listed out has a is necessary.
Well, and that's why I said I don't know if all. I mean, I assume right. Okay.
But look, I think if your question is, you know, will are we entirely focused on having the stock trading at NAV, and is it our expectation? Like, I think we've built a business plan around the assumption that. You know, we can't be assured that we have an ability to issue equity at IFRS or above it. And, you know, there's a number of tools in our portfolio, including what we've been doing, which is selling assets. I think some of the advantages of some of the structural things that you just mentioned are that we are actually able to very actively recycle capital and redeploy it. And so, we have a business plan that's not built around, and our continued growth not built around necessarily having to access the public markets. I think if it becomes a an efficient cost of capital to raise equity rather than continuing to sell assets, then we may do that. And if it doesn't, then, you know, we're happy to continue doing the opposite, which is recycling at the asset level and using that to help grow the platform.
Right. I guess to your point, your stock doesn't necessarily have to trade at IFRS to be a good stock. Right, so if you're seeing growth in the underlying NAV per share and you can make accretive investments by not having to raise equity in the public domain but raise it privately or through asset sales, you can still get good growth in cash flow and ultimately good growth in the underlying stock.
Right, and that's really what our focus on the NAV and growing the NAV is, even if the percentage discount that we're trading at for whatever reason that is stays the same. If we're able to grow that NAV at 10 to 12%, you're going to see good performance. In addition to the dividend.
Just last question, just on a Manhattan West. Can you sort of just provide a current status update in terms of the office leasing that's going on, but also whether you guys participated and how you participated in either Moynihan or in Penn Station redevelopment, either both or one of them, in terms of the bidding process?
Yeah, Michael, good morning. It's Rick. Maybe I'll take that. And I'd start by saying Manhattan West continues to progress as planned, and we expect it to be a great economic success for us. Construction's on schedule, within budget. Recent milestones there, we topped off 3 Manhattan West, which is our residential tower, a few weeks ago. Expect our first tenants to move in within a year. So we're on track to be the first of the major developments in that area to deliver an apartment building. 5 Manhattan West is effectively fully leased. The redevelopment of it will be done around most of it by the end of the year. Some of it will spill over into the first quarter of next year. 1 Manhattan West is on target as well. Skadden took down a couple of additional floors through an option over the last quarter, so we're now 30% leased. We have about 3 million square feet of leasing prospects activity that's going on throughout the entire project, so we're pretty excited about that. We've got a great basis, so we can be pretty competitive over there. So, you know, all in all, we remain excited about the project. Between us and the other large development, I think we're creating, probably the most exciting mixed-use neighborhood in the entire country. As far as the Moynihan Station, I think that's all part of continuing to create that neighborhood. Although I can't comment specifically on our involvement, I would say it's fair to guess that we're not a disinterested party in seeing it succeed, and we'll do what we can to make sure that it does. As to the Penn Station part of that project, I think there's one natural company that has a bit of an edge, owning all the real estate around that. But again, everything that's happening over there, I think, is good news for New York City.
Oh, there's one way you can buy the whole company. I'm just kidding. All right. Have a good night.
All right. Thanks.
And with no further questions in the queue at this time, I'd like to turn it back over to Mr. Brian Kingston for any additional or closing remarks.
Great. Thank you, everyone, for joining the call today, and we look forward to providing another update next quarter.
And ladies and gentlemen, that concludes today's conference call. We thank you for your participation.